from London, BBC Caribbean Report.
A modern CARICOM secretariat with teeth, that's what CARICOM leaders say they want. The French Caribbean seeks more direct relations with their English-speaking neighbours and a new vision for West Indies cricket, and everyone's invited to discuss it.
There must be a regional debate in the communities right through the next cricket season, out of which the people will speak, and we will gather what they have said and put it into some kind of format.
I'm Debbie Ransom, and this is BBC Caribbean Report. Transforming the CARICOM secretariat into an action-focused organisation to meet the needs of the 21st century. That was one of the major decisions taken at the just-concluded 7th Special CARICOM Summit. CARICOM Secretary-General Edwin Carrington told a final news conference that the existing secretariat machinery is incapable of research and implementation. Tony Fraser was at the news conference and raised the question of modernising the Georgetown-based secretariat.
From the responses at the news conference, it seems apparent that it has finally dawned on CARICOM leaders that there is need for a secretariat modernized and fully equipped to meet the lofty goals set out for the movement. Secretary General Dr. Edwin Carrington says the decision was taken to study the needs of the secretariat and place that report before the heads at their intersessional meeting next February. But I asked Dr. Carrington for the obvious areas of the secretariat that are in need of immediate attention.
One of the areas in which the secretariat is deficient at the moment is the need for a research unit. We also do not have the capacity when we come to the stage of implementation of these very protocols. Protocol 2, which deals with, for example, the provision of services, movement of capital, and right of establishment. When you come to implement those areas, you need more than the single unit representative we have in the secretariat, which deals with those matters at this time. So that the restructuring of the secretariat, without prejudging the recommendation of the experts who would recommend, would be to equip the organization to not just conceive of and prepare proposals for, but also to give them the capacity to implement.
The Secretary General says proposals will have to be made and decisions will be taken on what degree of decision-making authority will be given to the four ministerial councils in CARICOM. Taking up the discussion, President of Guyana, Barat Jagdeo, says the crucial decision will be for the heads of government to give decision-making power to several institutions in CARICOM.
If we did not focus on the implementation issues, something that we have been extremely weak at, then the single market and economy will not be in place in a very short period. It comes back to the issue of devolution of authority. Unless we devolve authority to somebody to manage the process, the single market and economy will not be implemented.
As expected, the treaty to establish the Caribbean Court of Justice was not signed at the meeting. Trinidad and Tobago's Foreign Minister Ralph Marad says there is need for additional work on the protocols to establish the court. He reiterated that October 2000 has been set as the time when the court will be inaugurated. Tony Fraser in Port of Spain for BBC Caribbean Report.
And Tony will be back later in the programme looking at the future of West Indies cricket. Meanwhile, CARICOM governments have also called on Guyana's political leaders to meet as soon as possible. St. Lucia's Prime Minister Kenny Anthony, the region's point man on the stalemated political dispute over 1997 elections, visited Georgetown on an assessment trip. He then delivered a report to his colleagues at the Port of Spain mini-summit. Dr. Anthony, now back in St. Lucia, explained the case being made to Guyana's political leaders when he spoke to our correspondent Pete Nimval in Castries.
To some extent, both of them have erected artificial barriers that prevent genuine engagement, genuine exchange. What I can tell you is this. The Guyanese people are very clear that their political leaders must talk with each other. They are clear that their political leaders must address the burning issues and the burning problems in the country. In fact, they're saying that a first step to resolving some of the differences, some of the perceptions, some of the difficult issues regarding race, regarding the distribution of house lots, a precondition for these things must be a meeting between the political leaders. They feel that if that can happen, then it will, that engagement will pave the way for solutions. So I'm making a simple point, that CARICOM is disappointed that the political representatives did not advance a dialogue, that they continue to erect these artificial barriers. But at the same time, one has to recognize that shaping dialogue between a governing party and an opposition party is always a challenging proposition. I think the heads have made it absolutely clear that the matter of the dialogue is so important to the Guyanese people, and by extension, to the continued involvement of CARICOM in the process, that both leaders must meet as soon as possible and without establishing preconditions or creating artificial barriers.
How important to CARICOM is the resolution of the Guyana situation?
When you speak of the resolution of the Guyana situation, again, one has to be very careful. Insofar as the constitution reform process is concerned, there has been some movement, considerable progress, and we need to emphasize that. Obviously, CARICOM would want Guyana to return to normalcy. CARICOM would continue to be very disturbed about allegations involving racial discrimination or other allegations that impact on the political process and compromise the governance of the country.
St. Lucia's Prime Minister Kenny Anthony speaking to Pete Ninval. The Commonwealth team of ministers now in Pakistan have met with representatives from the ousted government. The team, which includes the Barbadian Foreign Minister Billy Miller, will recommend to Commonwealth leaders whether or not to expel Pakistan from the organization. That's a decision they'll make at their summit in South Africa in 2 weeks' time. Orin Gordon reports.
The team, which is headed by the Canadian Foreign Minister Lloyd Axworthy, has already met with the President, the new Foreign Minister, and the Chief Justice of Pakistan. General Pervez Musharraf seized power in a coup 2 weeks ago. The ousted Prime Minister, Nawaz Sharif, remains in detention, and it's not at all certain whether Ms. Miller and company will get to see him. In the meantime, they'll try to get some kind of concrete assurance from General Musharraf that he intends to return Pakistan to civilian rule soon. But according to the Pakistani Foreign Affairs spokesman Tariq Altaf, very little's changed except who's in charge.
We will urge them to see, first of all, that the reaction of the people of Pakistan has been very positive to this change. Then we will point out to them that the elected president continues in his office. There is no martial law in the country. The courts are working as normal. Civil liberties are preserved. Human rights are guaranteed. Freedom of the press has been reaffirmed. The press is very free. The normal law of the land is applicable everywhere.
But neither that nor the fact that there is significant support for the coup in Pakistan will be enough for the Commonwealth. Their approach to Nigeria has been that military rule is simply not welcome. BBC Caribbean Report understands that they're wary of the image of bemedaled generals getting up to address their meetings. The Commonwealth decided enough was enough when under Guyanese Shridath Ramphal, they condemned the excesses of the former Ugandan dictator Idi Amin at their 1977 meeting in London. Commonwealth watchers believe that that was the beginning of the current line on military rulers within the 54-member body. Ironically, Pakistan was readmitted to the Commonwealth when a military man, Zia-ul-Haq, was president. The civilian prime minister was technically in charge, but it was widely acknowledged that General Zia was the real power in the country. It's unlikely that General Musharraf will be afforded the same luxury by the Commonwealth.
Orin Gordon. French Prime Minister Lionel Jospin is wrapping up a visit to Martinique, part of a wider trip around the French Caribbean. With unemployment at one-third of the population, banana prices down, and continuing high-profile protests by pro-independence groups, the relationship between France and its overseas département has not been good. Now Martinique and Guadeloupe are asking for more direct relations with their English neighbours rather than seeking links with CARICOM countries via Paris. I spoke to journalist Marie-Claude Celeste in Fort de France to find out how Martinique currently does business with its neighbours.
If one of the, for instance, the president of the regional council or the president of the general council, the president of the general assemblies, if they want to invite another leader in the Caribbean, let's say, for instance, the Prime Minister of Antigua or the Prime Minister of St. Lucia, it has to go through Paris, through the Ministry of External Affairs in Paris.
So what are the territories proposing to Prime Minister Jospin during his visit?
A sort of, you know, not a change in the constitution, but it's a change in the procedures so that they can talk to the Caribbean leaders directly. Secondly, what they want is also to be able to pass agreements with these countries, especially concerning such issues as fishing. You know, we have problems sometimes. Our fishermen have problems with St. Lucia, with Dominica, because they say that our fishermen are, you know, are fishing in their territorial waters, and we cannot, you know, find a lasting solution to the problem, because it has to do with the rules of the European Union, and anyway, it's the French government who is able to negotiate, you know, these kind of agreements and treaties.
Marie-Claude Celeste in Fort de France. Just a reminder that you're listening to BBC Caribbean Report. And now back to the just-concluded CARICOM mini-summit, where the state of West Indian cricket was also discussed. Those talks coincided with a report from a senior selection committee of the West Indies Cricket Board saying that poor technique was responsible for the team's recent bad performances. The Windies came last in the recent three-nation tournament in Sharjah. Well, CARICOM leaders made time to sit down and try and work out a longer-term solution during the CARICOM meeting. Tony Fraser spoke to the Barbadian cricket historian, Professor Hilary Beckles, after that session.
It seems to most members of governments that cricket, or West Indian cricketers, seems to be the least intellectually prepared of all the major competitors in terms of their planning, their thinking, their strategic adjustments, organization of their strategies and so on, and something must be done to bring them into what we consider to be an educational discourse to sharpen their management and strategic planning. The Australians have come up with a strategic plan, which is their academy. In Asia, what you'll see is a major redefinition of the game. They've democratized the program, they've driven the game in deeper into the communities, and they have found new sources of energy, which is why the center of gravity, I think, has shifted towards Asia in terms of cricket culture. I think the West Indian cricket culture has not grown. It has declined, in fact. There's a view also that says that the cricket seems to be detaching itself from the nationalist impulse in the region by virtue of being commodified, globalized, and professionalized, in fact. But even though that is true, it still has to maintain closely bound to its social mandate, and its social mandate is to express the creativity of West Indian people. All of these points were taken on board, and I think they have said, let the people discuss this. The West Indies Cricket Board is only one stakeholder. The cricket belongs to the people, and I think the critical message which is coming out of this conference is this: cricket must not be allowed to be taken away from its social ownership. Cricket is the cultural commodity of the people, and they should best know what to do with it. And there must be a regional debate in the communities right through the next cricket season, out of which the people will speak, and we will gather what they have said and put it into some kind of format.
Okay, and that's a question. West Indians are never short on the solutions for our cricket dilemma, the state we've got into now. The kinds of mechanisms that are required to capture some of the sense and the essence of what people think about what has to be done about our cricket. Are those mechanisms conceived of yet, and what will they be?
Well, this is why we have said that this conference must not take place in a hotel, on a campus. This has to be a public conference. And therefore, we're going to use the multimedia as the mechanisms, the modalities for this conference. It will take place on the radios, it will take place on television, on the internet, and the newspapers, and community halls. All of the modalities of communication and interface will be used. And after 3 months of public discourse, we will, of course, monitor all of that and drive all of that by a central steering committee. Each country will come up with its own program and its own method. We will articulate all of that and bring that information finally to the university for a plenary session where the stakeholders will come together and put together a strategic vision.
And Hilary Beckles in Port of Spain ends this evening edition of BBC Caribbean Report. More news in the morning. I'm Debbie Ransom, saying goodbye from London.